You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park. If you were living in the archaic period of the 8th century to the 6th century BC, towards the end of antiquity, your worldview might have been fairly simple. You would have thought there were four basic elements that composed all the things in the universe: fire, water, air, and earth. In the mythology of virtually every culture, fire is a sacred substance that gives life or power. A lot of the early mythos are people being born from fire, earth and life being risen from the fire. But fire is actually not a tangible substance. When you're looking at a campfire and you're watching the flames rise and crackle and dance around in the dark, you're actually not observing an object. You're observing a process. It's a chemical reaction. It's the same chemical reaction that occurs when you leave your bike outside too long and it turns rusty, or when an apple or an avocado on the table turns brown. It's the process called oxidation. It combines oxygen with another substance. We talked about how oxygen is actually one of the main elements to give us life. But if you were in ancient Greece, you wouldn't have known about that. You would have called it air, or you would have called it fire. I guess the difference between your avocado on your table and fire is speed. Fire is an oxidation process that happens very fast, so that light, heat, and sound are released. And they're often released with enough force to justify these ancient cultures' reverence. Fire is a very powerful thing. The sudden release of energy causes temperatures to rise, and sometimes it can do this by thousands of degrees almost instantly. Fire also gives out a return, smoke. It's sort of this toxic waste of fire that's left over. It takes something else, and it does something else. It takes something original, and it changes it. What could be a perfectly beautiful house, perfectly beautiful person, perfectly beautiful tree, or a perfectly beautiful plot of land can be destroyed very quickly because of fire. There are many scholars and historians that say that fire is what makes us human. It's what sets us apart from other species. The ability to do one thing, not to see fire, not to start fire, but this is important, to control fire. Other species can see fire. Other things can create fire. We have seen it happen. Things can accidentally happen. If you look on YouTube, you can start fire with an orange. There are all kinds of ways to start fire. Starting fire is not the hard part. Learning to control fire is. Remember that most of the entire history of human beings, of sapiens, we lived as foragers. We would scavenge what we could on the plains, eating mostly raw food. And if we came across a dead carcass, that's what we would eat. If we were able to kill one, then we got really lucky. But for most of human history, we lived as foragers. It's only in the last 200,000 years of human history that our ability to change what we eat has changed. Now, fire is inextricably connected to what we eat. Why is what we eat so important? Why is food so important? If you grew up as a modern woman, especially in the 80s and 90s, when diet fads became all the rage in Western culture, you'll know how life can revolve around food. I grew up with Weight Watchers commercials on TV all the time and counting calories and the introduction of fat-free foods like fat-free sour cream and fat-free cottage cheese and all of these things. And we developed a culture as women, as American women, around dieting, right? Not that dieting is specific to American Western women, but food is absolutely an important part of who we are as human beings. In fact, everything has always revolved around food. Sociologists, anthropologists, archaeologists, historians, scientists will all argue that food really shapes how we do everything. if we have access to food, then it changes our living conditions, our sexual behavior, our political behavior, our economic behavior. All of this matters. Food and our ability to engage with it is a critical step in understanding us as a species. Now remember, 200,000 years is about the amount of time that we've been eating how we would recognize as modern humans, as sapiens eating. 200,000 years is a dot. It's a speck in the entirety of human history, which is millions of years. There are all kinds of theories that deal with how human beings engage with food and how we've come to engage with food, from being foragers, from eating a completely raw diet, say, like our, you know, bonobo cousins, and just eating raw food, to actually cooking food. And fire is an important element. When humans developed the ability to control fire, it changed everything. Because fire not only affected food, which we're going to talk about, but it changed everything. There are some wild approximate estimates of when the ability to control fire was actually discovered. It goes from anywhere from 125,000 years ago to earlier. There are evidence for the controlled use of fires from Homo erectus beginning some 400,000 years ago, and that has a lot of wide scholarly support. Some of the earliest claims for the control of fires by members of the Homo species range from about 0.2 to 1.7 million years ago. Some of those are considered more controversial, but we're still finding these out. Now, there are all kinds of fascinating theories and ideas of food and human evolution, like the gorging gene theory, which is, why do human beings like sweet things so much? Well, the theory is, if you were on the plains and foraging for food, food was hard to come by, you had to eat what you could, and when you came upon a berry bush that hadn't been picked away by birds or other animals, your evolutionary strategy would be to gorge on as many of those sweet things as possible all in one sitting, because your body wouldn't see them for a long time, and so your body would store up these calories. And there's all this fascinating evidence to back this up, and there's also all this controversial stuff in the field of diabetic research right now. They're trying to understand why our bodies process food the way that they do, and why we process calories the way that we do, and how it seems that, you know, as modern humans, we're going against our own evolutionary best interest by eating a ton of food that isn't good for us. It's making us obese. It's causing us all kinds of health problems. Why would we do that? It goes against our best interests. Well, scientists believe that because this evolution sped up so fast in only a period of 200,000 years, we have not yet evolved to process food in a way that's going to be for our best interests. Now, the reason why fire changes things is it's not just because, you know, it cooked meat and so it killed a lot of germs or it made food taste better, although that's an important part of fire. What fire actually does to our food is it outsources some of our body's work of digestion so that more of the energy from the food is extracted and we don't have to spend so much energy processing the food in our bodies. Cooking does a lot of things to the food. It breaks down collagen, it breaks down the connective tissue in meat, and it softens the cell walls of plants to release their stores of starch and fat. The calories to fuel the bigger brains of successive species of hominids came at the expense of the energy-intensive tissue in the gut, which was shrinking at the same time as this was all happening. Some scientists will argue that the barrel-shaped trunk of apes morphed in the comparatively narrow waist of Homo sapiens because of this. So fire unlocked nutrients. In fact, one of the scientists who argues that fire was actually way earlier than previously expected is anthropologist Richard Wrangham. He's an anthropologist at Harvard, and he claims that hominids developed the control of fire about 1.8 million years ago. Here's an article that L.V. Anderson from Slate magazine wrote about Wrangham's theory. Here's what she says, quote, "Wrangham's theory is elegant, but the archaeological record is a little more complicated. There's a definitely evidence of fire around 1.6 million years ago in what is now Kenya, but archaeologists dispute whether this was man-made or natural fire. Further complicating Wrangham's hypothesis is evidence that hominids may not have brought fire with them when Homo erectus moved out of Africa into Europe around a million years ago. If fire was as transformative and beneficial as Wrangham said it was, you'd think our ancestors would have brought it with them when they moved to colder climates or died out when they were unable to do so. If Homo erectus didn't bring fire mastery to Europe, who did? Archaeologists Will Roberts of Leiden University in the Netherlands and Paula Vila of the University of Colorado Museum found evidence for frequent use of fire by European Neanderthals between 400,000 and 300,000 years ago. They looked at the data collected at European sites by hominids and found no evidence of fires before that. It doesn't mean that they don't exist, they just haven't found it yet. But they found plenty after that threshold. Several sites from all over the world would back up those theories about 400,000 years ago. One thing that is really interesting about Wrangham are actually not just his ideas about fire, but his idea about food. Wrangham is a critic of the raw foods diet. It bothers him, this raw foods craze that has swept most of privileged Western nations, not only because he thinks it's incorrectly labeled to sort of this primitive diet, but he thinks that it's not healthy. Wrangham claims to stay out of this political food debate, but in his book, Catching Fire, he argues that the raw foods diet is not healthy for children. He acknowledges it's a terrific way for adults to lose weight. But, he said, it is literally possible to starve to death even while filling one's stomach with raw food. He cites that in the wild, people typically only survive a few months without cooking, even if they can obtain meat. He cites evidence that urban raw foodists, despite year-round access to bananas, nuts, and other high-quality agricultural products, as well as juicers, blenders, and dehydrators, are often underweight, which, of course, the raw food advocates are a huge fan of. But Wrangham considers it alarming that in one study, half the women were malnourished to the point that they stopped menstruating. They are presumably eating all that they want and may even be consuming what appears to be an adequate number of calories based on modern USDA tables. But there's growing evidence in his view that overstates sometimes to a considerable degree the energy that the body extracts from whole raw foods. Most of the food that you take in comes in raw starch and protein, and it's absorbed by the body directly via the small intestine, and the remainder passes into the large bowel where it's broken down by the microbes and bacteria in your organs, which consume most of those nutrients. But cooked food is mostly digested by the time it enters the colon. For the same amount of calories ingested, your body gets roughly 30% more energy from cooked oats, wheat, or potato starch as compared to raw food, and as much as 78% from the protein in an egg. So fire actually does things. It transforms our food and makes it more nutritionally beneficial. Another thing fire does, of course, is it kept us warm, and it allowed for us to find ways to possibly harass our enemies. There is evidence that maybe some early bands of humans used it to burn out encroaching bands of hominids. Fire did so much for us. Now, we talked a lot about bipedalism, the ability to walk on 2 feet, and of course that is critically important because the ability to walk on 2 feet means your hands are free. So you have your feet on the ground and now you have hands and you can use your hands. You can use them for weapons. You can use them for more access to food. You can use them to do things. You can use them to hunt. You can use them to fight off things. So as we're becoming bipedal and we're learning to control fire, we're learning to develop our food. It frees up more time. It frees up more time for culture. Fire actually, a lot of theories say that fire enabled us to do this as well. That the birth of culture happens around fire. Because here we are now, instead of running to keep warm or huddling to keep warm, you can reasonably relax around a fire, have your safety somewhat taken care of, your energy somewhat taken care of, your heat somewhat taken care of, and your light and ability somewhat taken care of, but you have to sit. You have to sit and be close to the fire. And this is how culture starts to form, some cultural anthropologists believe. And now this sets the stage for a really good campfire story that I want to tell you. Fire is so important, and it's allowed us to do this, to tell stories, to develop the ability to talk and communicate, not just in warnings and not just from day-to-day things, but to actually create a culture. So let me tell you the story of my own. This is one of my favorite stories so far. It's the story of Granny Glutton. Now, if you were to sit around the cooking fire with elders of the Nage people, which is an indigenous tribe of the island of Flores in Indonesia, they would tell you the story of Granny Glutton and the Ibu Gogo. In Nage, Ebu means grandmother and Gogo means he who eats anything. Here's what the story would go like if you're sitting around this fire. If you are brave enough or possibly foolish enough, you might venture into the deep forest of Flores and follow the volcanic ash into the jungle. There you might stumble upon a lava cave hidden in the brush. Being curious and going out to explore the beautiful island in Indonesia, your curiosity might get the best of you. And you might decide you want to explore these lava caves, left over from ancient volcanic ash, seemingly flat on top but disappearing into the earth, into tunnels and tunnels below. Perhaps after a day of exploring, you'll be tired and want to camp for the night near the opening of one of these caves. Warmed by your fire and surrounded by the sounds of these forest creatures, and as you drift slowly to sleep, you'll almost start dreaming when you'll be awakened suddenly by the screams of a little child. As you rub the sleep from your eyes, you realize the cries are coming from a tiny child, a baby, and they're not cries of happiness, they're cries of distress. This is the sound of a baby being taken from its mother. Without warning, shadows will flicker past your camp, and the crying will get louder and louder. You'll hear weird humming noises and squeaks and the screams of this distressed child. Through the jungle darkness, you'll catch a glimpse of tiny little demons, not more than 3 feet high, laughing with evil glee as they greedily carry this kidnapped infant into the lava cave past you. Deeper and deeper, their cries will disappear into the cave, the child never to return to its mother or to be seen or heard from again. What you'll have witnessed, this terror in the night, is the craven rituals of the Ebu Gogo, of Granny Glutton. It's a tribe of hairy dwarfs with pot bellies swelling from a steady diet of human children, with breasts from the women that swing from side to side, sometimes so long they can throw them over their shoulders. The cackles and shrieks that they make are mixed with a low hum. It's said by the Nage people that the Ebu Gogo will take your children if they can, but mostly they spend their time raiding crops, stealing anything, and eating anything. And if it happens to be your child, so be it. These little creatures have long arms with long curly fingers, perfect for snatching, and they can swallow kidnapped infants whole, right into their big ventral cavities. The Ebu Gogo are said to have ate everything raw, including vegetables, fruits, meat, and human meat. And it's said that they would even eat the dinnerware. But there's one way to protect yourself and your children from the Ebu Gogo. The Ebu Gogo have a solid weakness, bamboo. Specifically, combs made of bamboo, which terrify these Nage wild people. So the Nage people would take bamboo and make them into sharp combs and carry them. One story tells of a Nage Gogo that swallowed pots and rice mortars and vessels. And once they killed the little creature, her stomach was cut open with this dreaded bamboo comb, and all the stolen goods, the pots and the vessels, were spilled open out of her belly and retrieved from her guts. Other stories talk about the Ibu Gogo sneaking in and stealing things and taking it back to their Liaula caves called Caves of the Children. Now, there are similar stories along the island, the Anaula, who they call the Banished Children. It's a tribe similar to the Ibu Gogo, and their noises are squeaking sounds rather than the sounds. It's said that the Ebu Gogo murmured at each other and could repeat words spoken by the villagers verbatim, almost like a parrot. For example, if a villager would say to the Ebu Gogo, "Here's some food," they would reply, "Here's some food." This story is still told today by some of the indigenous tribes in Indonesia. It is also said that as early as 1930, anthropologists were there on the island, and Nage women would go in crews and take turns and shifts walking around with the bamboo combs at night. Strangely, though, an Abu Gogo has not been found on the island. And there's a reason for this. The common story of the Abu Gogo's demise is a dark one. It's a story of a Cretan Holocaust. Legend says that when the local Nage people, tired of having to defend their sleeping infants from the dull-witted Abu Gogo, they lured them into a trap. Here's what they did. It's said that one night the village people got together and laid out a big feast right inside the Liaula cave, complete with food and drink and palm fiber. The Abu Gogo came back from raiding, and there they see in their cave a grand feast laid out for them. They didn't question why they got so lucky. Instead, they greedily ate of the food. And then, when they were full, they gathered in circle dancing, and they drank the wine into excess. In their dull-witted state, as is their way, they mistook the palm fiber that was on the ground for clothing, and they draped themselves in this highly combustible plant. As they fell asleep, it said the cave door was closed, and the villagers tossed a bale of burning grass into the cave. But not before the palm fiber was lit on fire and all the Abu Gogo were burned into extinction. Now, of course, other variations of the story say that they didn't burn to death, but some ran out of the cave, singed but not fried, and they were last seen heading west in the direction of Liangbua. That's where the story goes. Now, Liangbua will come into play in just a minute. But in 1930, when these women were taking these combs around, they were actually not trying to ward off the Abu Gogo themselves, but their ghosts and their spirits, who they believe still plague the camps today. Now, for years, these campfire stories were nothing more than folklore. But that all changed in 2003. Before I tell you how that changed, I want to give you a little bit of background on Indonesia. Now, anthropologists, sociologists, archaeologists, and scientists have been interested in Indonesia for a long time. Tucked between Australia and Thailand, Indonesia is made up of thousands of volcanic islands and is home to hundreds of ethnic groups speaking many different languages. It's known for its lush resources. It's got beaches, volcanoes, jungles sheltering elephants, tigers, and Komodo dragons. Here's what Yuval Noah Harari says. The first human footprint on a sandy Australian beach was immediately washed away by waves. Yet when the invaders advanced inland, they left behind a different footprint, one that would never be expunged. As they pushed on, they encountered a strange universe of unknown creatures that included a 450-pound, 6-foot kangaroo and a marsupial lion, as massive as a modern tiger, that was the continent's largest predator. Koalas, far too big to be cuddly and cute, rustled in the trees, and flightless birds twice the size of ostriches sprinted on the plains. Dragon-like lizards and snakes 7 feet long slithered through the undergrowth. The giant Diprodon, a 2.5-ton wombat, roamed the forests. Except for the birds and reptiles, all these animals were marsupials, like kangaroos, and they gave birth to tiny, helpless, fetus-like young, which they then nurtured with milk in abdominal pouches. Marsupial mammals were almost unknown in Africa and Asia, but in Australia, they reigned supreme. Within a few thousand years, virtually all these giants vanished. Of the 24 Australian animal species weighing 100 pounds or more, 23 became extinct. A large number of smaller species also disappeared. Food chains throughout the entire Australian ecosystem were broken and rearranged. It was the most important transformation of the Australian ecosystem for millions of years. When sapiens arrive in this area, things begin to change radically. We know that fossils and the remains of tools from the Indonesian archipelago was inhabited by Homo erectus around 1.5 million years ago, and the famous bones Java Man are from this area as well. In 2011, evidence was uncovered in neighboring East Timor, showing that 42,000 years ago, these early settlers were catching and consuming large numbers of deep-sea fish such as tuna, and that they had technology needed to make ocean crossings to reach Australia and other islands. Java Man was all the rage in these islands. This is where the fossil was known. They thought they were unlocking a lot of secrets. But Java Man isn't the only thing Indonesia is known for. This brings us back to Granny Glutton. In 2003, a joint Indonesian-Australian research team found LB1, which was a nearly complete female skeleton. The skeleton of LB1 was a tiny human that lived at least 18,000 years ago in the Liangbua Cave on the island of Flores. Remember how I told you about the story of these little creatures that run from the cave and they head west towards Liangbua? This is where the fossils were found. The skeleton's unique traits were different from, say, Java Man or any of these other fossils they had been finding. It had a small body and small brain size, and so at first they thought maybe it was a child. Later, scientists assigned the skeleton fossils to a new species, Homo floresiensis, which was named after the island that it was found on, Flores. At first they thought it was a child, but the permanent teeth indicated otherwise. This little sapien was definitely an adult at the time of death, a female at about 30 years old. Dean Falk, who is an American academic anthropologist and specializes in the evolution of the brain and cognition in higher primates, was there. And she actually is going to come on. We're so lucky to have her come on. She is renowned, and I'm just honored to have her on the show. So I'm going to let her talk a little bit about her find first.
I'm Dean Falk, and I am a paleoanthropologist. I teach at Florida State University, and I'm also a senior scholar at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I do research.
I think you're being extremely humble. You've written a lot of books. You're really prolific. I think you're one of the most famous anthropologists of our time, so it's just such an honor to have you.
Well, thank you, and I am honored that you said that. Thank you so much.
So I brought you on because we've been talking about, you know, these oral histories of the Agugogo and sort of the Homo floresiensis. I hope I'm saying that right. And you played an integral part in that. You worked on some endocasts, and you helped with a huge controversy surrounding these fossils. So I was hoping you could just tell us briefly about your involvement.
At the end of 2004, I received a phone call from somebody from National Geographic Society, whom I almost hung up on because I briefly thought he might be selling a magazine subscription. And he was doing a television documentary on a new species that was about to come out, the announcement of it, in Nature. And he was not able to call before then because it had been embargoed, so it was a secret. And he said, I can only call now. The embargo has just lifted. And he proceeded to tell me about this new species of an early human named Homo floresiensis, nicknamed Hobbit, that had been discovered on a little island in Indonesia, the island of Flores. And it was an adult female, a fairly complete skeleton. And she stood about 3 feet tall. And she had long arms and was found with fragments of other individuals that looked like her. And there were little miniature elephant-like things, stegodonts, and giant lizards. And they hunted these and they made tools. And as he told me this, you know, I said, are you making this up? And he laughed and he said, no, I can assure you this is true. And I'm phoning because the discoverer, Michael Morwood, the late Michael Morwood, is inviting you to describe the brain from the inside of the brain cave. That was how I learned about it. It was tremendously exciting. And so I assembled a team, my dear colleagues at Mallinckrodt Institute of Radiology in St. Louis, and we asked for the CAT scan data of the skull, which was sent to St. Louis. And then this fabulous team reconstructed the brain by CAT scanning the skull, because from that you can recreate the shape of the brain and the details of the outside part, the cerebral cortex. So we proceeded to do that and then to describe the surface of the brain and to compare it to apes and to some other fossils. And so that got us going. And as you know, it became very, very controversial because some scientists said, oh, this couldn't possibly be a new species at that date, which was 18,000 years ago. back to 95,000 in this part of the world that looks this way. It's impossible. So what you have here is a pathological contemporary person. And that, and the initial claim was that the individual had microcephaly or a small brain or small head. And so what we needed to do then was answer that. And to answer it, we had to study something we never dreamt we'd be studying, which is microcephaly. So we went in a new direction and did write a paper that I think thoroughly addressed that. And then the same individuals came up with a different disease, Laron syndrome. So we had to address that. And then it was, and once that went away, it was cretinism. So Peter Brown addressed that. And now it's Down syndrome. And a fabulous scientist named Karen Babb is leading the efforts to address that, and that's well underway. So it's been controversial. And I'm prepared to hear of a new suggestion, a new disease, any day now.
Why do you think it's been so controversial? Is it just scientists being rigorous, or do you think that there's something else going on?
I think this is a pattern that's been with us since there's been a fossil record related to people. Since the oldest discovery that was recognized as a potential human relative, which happened to be a Neanderthal, and this was 1856, there was the same kind of reception. And after that, there was Homo erectus, then known as Pithecanthropus, and it was the same kind of reception with the first Australopithecine ever announced. That was in 1925. It was the Tong baby, Australopithecus africanus. Always, there's a small group of professionals that say, no, no, it can't be. And they always say, you either have an errant ape or a pathological human being. So this is a pattern, and it's a predictable pattern now. And what happens is, what has happened in these other cases, is that eventually more specimens, more fossils are discovered, and then eventually the discovery is accepted. So we're at the point where investigators are hunting for more fossils. We're 10 or 11 years out from the announcement. And it's actually quite remarkable the degree to which this already is being accepted as a legitimate new species. It's in the textbooks, but we still have that handful of people who are saying, no, no, it can't be.
Can you talk about your experiences being a woman anthropologist and scientist in the field?
Sure. You know, it's paleoanthropology in general is a feisty, you know, field. It's there are a lot of sort of paleo, what I call paleopolitics, maybe because it's easy to have strong opinions about very old things where until we get the time machine, you know, it's really difficult to prove what's right and what's wrong. And it is primarily a man's field. There aren't too many women in the field, with a famous exception of Maeve Leakey. You know, the Leakeys have, and now Louise Leakey, and formerly Mary Leakey. But other than that, there aren't too many women in the field, particularly senior women. And to be a woman, you know, in a field that is already very, very political, has been challenging. And it's, you know, I've experienced challenges to do with sort of controversy since I've been publishing, you know, since my first paper on Australopithecines in 1980. And that doesn't go away. That said, I do want to say there are some really, really good and supportive male scientists. I don't mean to make it sound like everybody's beating up on the women. That's not the case.
Now, we've talked a little bit about Margaret Mead and sort of controversy and feminism, how, where it intersects with anthropology. Have you seen those sort of biases in, I guess, the abstraction from the data?
If I understand your question, are you asking whether or not people's biases in terms of gender comes into their interpretations of the actual data? Okay.
Yes.
As an example of the sort of paleopolitics that goes on, it's a pretty interesting one. of course, we always want to know, you know, what was it that made us human? What was the one main thing that drove the evolution of the brain and intelligence? And there have been various suggestions over the years of so-called prime movers, the main thing. And one of the best known ones, if just in all of the textbooks, is Man the Hunter. And this was became very well known in the 1970s, and it got in all the textbooks. And the idea was that all of the wonderfulness of humans was driven by males hunting. Other suggestions had to do with tool production, for instance, again with the emphasis being on males. So after Man the Hunter became so prominent, I'd say within a decade, a group of female, mostly female anthropologists came up with an alternative, which they called Woman the Gatherer. And what they showed was that if you look at people living in non-industrialized societies around the world, that in fact it usually is, not always, but it usually is the men that do the hunting, and the women and their children that are off gathering plant food or lizards and eggs, and that in fact who ends up feeding, providing most of the calories, are the women. At the end of the day, you might or might not have some meat from Man the Hunter, but most of the sustenance for the social group comes from women. So that was Women the Gatherer. So these two examples show that, in fact, some of the, you know, gender politics does get into, you know, how people interpret the data that they see. And in most textbooks, you'll read about both Man the Hunter and Woman the Gatherer. I'm doing some work now in a field called Evo-Devo, or Evolutionary Developmental Biology, where, you know, looking at human evolution, and the focus now is on infants, and also fetuses, and newborn infants, and young infants. And it's becoming clearer, I think, that infants were really, really important for the evolutionary journey of humans, because evolution comes about often and largely through tweaking of the mechanisms of development itself. And I think that, in fact, babies maybe were more important than adult men and women in terms of charting the course, the path that evolution took. And so I call this baby the trendsetter. And it's something, you know, I'm working on now, just and will be working on for some time.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Do you want to say anything about the Evugogo?
Sure. So it's been fascinating working on Hobbit, and I was so privileged to be able to do so. And that work is ongoing and will be ongoing. But one of the things that came out is that there's a folklore on the island of Flores which talks about people that lived not that long ago called the Ibugogo. And they were very short and hairy, and they lived in caves. And there was some tension between the Ibugogo and the other people that lived on the island. And the suggestion has been made that maybe they were the hobbits. And we don't know, but what I like about this is it sort of keeps alive this fantasy of, well, if that were true, might we one day find living Ibugogo somewhere in the depths of the forest on Flora. So it's a fun idea. It probably won't happen, but it's fun to think about.
That's fantastic. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on and being willing to talk with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, and I look forward to receiving the link, and I will post it on my webpage.
I'm going to link to the Nature interview that Falk and Aola did, where they talk about their find and having to work with the male bias on the site. Now, as was said earlier, these fossil remains indicate that they were only about 3 feet 6 inches high, and there was a whole controversy about it being a diseased human or it not being a diseased human. Either way, Homo floresiensis was unveiled on October 28, 2004, and was quickly named the Hobbit after the fictional race popularized in J.R.R. Tolkien's book The Hobbit. And actually, one of the scientific names proposed for this species was Homo habitus. It was initially placed in its own genus, Pseudanthropus florenziensis, which means Pseudan human from Florus. But as the article comes out, reviewers of the article felt that the cranium, despite its size, belonged in the genus Homo. Now, what's interesting is that the Homo floresiensis lived in Florus from about 95,000 years to 17,000 years ago. Early humans would have arrived to the island of Florus itself about 800,000 years ago, based on stone tool findings. These hobbits and humans shared this island. It's controversial whether they used stone tools or not, but they were believed to have used stone tools because they hunted extinct elephant species, the Stegodon, along with large rodents, and could have possibly even controlled fire. Some researchers believe that given their physical attributes, the oral histories of the actual Ibu Gogo from the Nage peoples could be cultural memories of the ancient human ancestor. There's not a lot of scientific evidence to support that, but there's increasing scientific similarities to these stories. Of course, the stories of the Nage people could be flawed and aren't considered scientific evidence. Strangely enough, the legends do match up to the increasing scientific evidence. There are still teams digging up fossils in Ling Bua. It's amazing that these folktales, thousands of years old, passed down from one generation to another, can resemble science so closely. Western culture isn't comfortable with the use of oral histories. We like peer reviews and empirical data and published journals. It's said that those histories aren't the only important histories. And as we engage in this series, we'll try to remember this. If the Nage people had been writing these stories down for centuries in the form of cave drawings or papyri scripts, perhaps scholars would have taken them more seriously. But because they were seen nothing more as campfire legends, they were easily dismissed. Science could be redeeming their tales and shows us that we should be paying more attention to oral tradition. For our next episode, I brought on Dr. Elise Boxer, a native scholar, to tell us about the colonization of histories and why oral stories are so important. Thanks for listening to another episode of Story of Woman Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Bluehost. If you're interested in starting up your own website, this is a great way to do it. Click through my site at storyofwoman.org and click on the Bluehost link. That'll help support the podcast. You can also buy any of the books listed on the site through Amazon. That will support the podcast as well. Special thanks to Grace Boole, Jake Spurlock, Adam Groves, and Sarah Burlingame for all their help, and for Dr. Falk for coming on today. This amazing music is brought to you by Lady Murasaki. You can check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com.